John Mack for appellant.
Very good. Mr. Mack, please hold just a minute. The marshal will call us into session.
Okay, fine. Thank you.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Smith, Judge Klopaki, the Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Welcome to counsel and any other observers in the second case. This panel has six cases today, three with oral arguments and three without oral argument, solely on the briefs. The second case for oral argument is number A20-996 in the matter of the civil commitment of Esteban Trevino. I believe Mr. Mack, I assume both parties are familiar with our court's procedures for oral arguments, and in the video environment, they are as similar as possible to as they would be in the courtroom. So Mr. Mack, you may begin your argument. Thank you.
Before I begin, Judge, I'm having a little bit of difficulty hearing you. Okay. Your mic is not particularly loud, and I'm a little hard of hearing besides.
Well, I will. So I would ask my colleagues, am I audible to them in the normal way? And so is it, or is it a technical problem with on my end? Can my colleagues help me with that?
I can hear you fine.
Yeah, okay. It sounds fine. So.
Okay. And Mr. Mack, how do the other judges sound to you?
They sound fine. In fact, Judge Klopaki sounds louder than the other two judges.
Huh.
And I can tone it down.
am I still a little soft, low volume?
Oh, you're pretty good now, Judge. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Well, I'll make a point of trying to speak up, but I appreciate your letting me know. Just
okay. Thank you.
It's good to know. Thank you. You may begin.
John Mack for appellant. I'd like you to assume a hypothetical for a moment. Suppose this was the first commitment hearing in the state of Minnesota, and suppose this was the first appeal of a commitment hearing in the state of Minnesota. I think that there would be reason to think that you'd find this to be inadequate. What troubles me about this case is not any specific that the court did in Wilmer, but it's the entire process that seems to me to have been perfunctory and therefore, frankly, denied Mr. Trevino due process. There's a form letter for commitment that the judge has to sign and fill out, which basically directs him through the entire process. The whole report were in evidence without any kind of objection. There was no indication, a foundation of Seifert Lynch's testimony or how she arrived at her report. Her diagnosis differs from that of Dr. Lundberg. Why? A thought disorder could be virtually anything. I may very well have a thought disorder myself, and most of us probably do. We can't think of everything. There are where the doctors say that my client did not understand the risks or the benefits. I'm not sure that that's helpful without foundation. Neither do I. What are the risks and benefits of the medication he's expected to do? And there's a catch-22 that's involved in here. Because my client doesn't recognize that he's mentally ill, that's used to show that he's mentally ill. One of the things that does bother
me. Oh, that wasn't the only thing that was used, however.
Oh, of course not. But I'm saying that when we're talking about various things that are found to show that he's mentally ill, many of them are problematical and should have been challenged. For example, the fact that a person thinks that they're the Messiah impresses me as not something that you could use to show that somebody's mentally ill. There've been a fair number of important people in history who thought that they were Messiah who were not mentally ill. It was a fairly common thing, frankly, in Jewish history that various religious leaders claimed to be the Messiah. So that doesn't show that he's not.
We don't know. We don't know. Some of them may have been mentally ill as well. We don't know, do we?
It's possible, but the history of some of them, like say Sabbatai Zvi, indicates that he was very much tracking with what he was preaching to his people and what he was attempting to have them do. A lot of the material relied on the judges in this case were material from his original commitment. For example, I think Judge Seifert indicates, well, I wasn't able to talk to this individual because this individual wouldn't talk to me. But based upon the records that I've seen from his original commitment, it seems to me that he's clearly mentally ill. Now, one thing I should point out to the court, but I don't want to harp on this particularly, as is often the case in these commitment cases, things change radically by the time they get to the Court of Appeals. And there have been important things happening in this case, which I can't really relate to the court because they're not in the record. But suffice it to say that he still is under a commitment order. And therefore, in this particular case, the case is not moot, close, but not moot. One of the things that bothers me about these cases is that people...
What are you suggesting, that he may have been released?
Yeah. But under a conditional release so that the original commitment could be reimposed any time. Furthermore, he's allowed to take his own medications now. So that could, of course, go away if further problems develop. But of course, that doesn't make it entirely moot. It's not entirely moot because if on the street he's found to be problematical again, the commitment would be reimposed and he would have to go back to the facility. He's out on the street now. That's what I'm saying. I'm really troubled by this case. And the reason I'm troubled by the case is that we treat these people who've done nothing wrong, they just have mentally illness problems, are treated almost like assembly line people. A criminal, yes?
Oh, counsel. So I'm trying to understand. So based on the evidence that actually was admitted, are you challenging that the findings were clearly erroneous based on that? Or are you suggesting the evidence from the doctors, the expert and the treating doctor should not have been admitted because it lacked foundation, et cetera? I mean, when you challenge foundation, you know, unless foundation was unavailable for it, that's maybe just efficient lawyering to put in. That doesn't make a difference. If it had foundation, it had foundation. And I don't see you arguing that the reports lack or the evidence lacked foundation.
I mean,
is your argument that irrespective of the foundation, irrespective of whether foundation exists, a lawyer should always challenge it, and to do otherwise in these circumstances is to deprive the committed person of due process?
I think it is. I think that in a case like this, foundation should be challenged and wasn't challenged. Suppose that you're the mentally ill person.
But just assuming your statement that it should always be challenged, does that mean that if it isn't, it results in a conclusion of ineffective assistance of counsel?
Not in any given case. And I'd hate to say that Dawn Weber was inefficient because she's a very good lawyer. The problem is that in this case, and in a bunch of other cases that you see that are involved here, people get into a cycle of thinking, well, we automatically do not challenge a foundation in a case like this. For example, one of the problems in this case is that the diagnoses of the two psychiatrists in this case, or psychologists in one case, are very different. One, for example, determined that she had an unspecified, or he had an unspecified thought disorder. And what's that? And then the other one said that there was a schizophrenic problem involved, and there was some indications of paranoia. Now that should have been challenged. I guess what bothers me here is, suppose you're the participant in a case like this, and you just see your attorney saying, no objection, no objection, no objection. And the judge fills out a form saying, yes, you're crazy, go back to Anoka. I think that that's a real problem in our judicial system and the way we treat.
Counsel, if I may interrupt for a second, when you say that there are two different diagnoses and that should have been challenged.
Yes.
Are you saying that there was a failure to I mean, of course, one could, you could have one, there could be conflicting evidence in cases, there often is. Are you saying that it should have been challenged and somehow excluded because they weren't identical? Or are you saying it should have been challenged in terms of the lawyer effectively arguing to the judge that that one is more credible than the other, or that neither is credible, and so on? Like, what are you attacking, the admission of it, or the arguments by counsel regarding it, the effectiveness of counsel?
It isn't just the fact that that it should have been challenged on argument. One of the things that I really am troubled about this case is that on the foundation objection, I think there should have been a Fry-Mack hearing, particularly where you have conflicting opinions of this sort of thing. Why do you base this on? What? Where does it come from? Is it in the DSM? Are there conflicting kinds of diagnoses coming out? Why is this not junk science? So I think the admissibility is one of the problems. I hate to say ineffective assistance of counsel, because frankly, I've seen counsel do this thing dozens of times. It's just that we're on a conveyor belt. We say to ourselves, you know, this is not the kind of thing that we would take seriously like it were a criminal case, where we really would demand that the expert go through the hoops.
You're not claiming then ineffective assistance of counsel? What are you claiming?
I'm claiming that the entire process deprives my client of due process. And it deprives him of due process because the process is perfunctory. The counsel is not held to the same sorts of standards they would be in, say, a criminal case or even an ordinary civil case. And they're not being held to the kinds of, and the judge doesn't hold the witnesses to the kind of standards that you would expect when you're talking about admissibility of critical evidence. You're allowing essentially opinion evidence. This person is mentally ill and this person needs commitment with basically relevant.
The trial court never raised the question of, the trial counsel did not raise the question of due process at the hearing.
No, she didn't. But I think that issue is always available on appeal, because when you're looking at, as I am, a global failure of process, obviously the counsel is going to be part of that. So to consider this in the same way that you would an ordinary civil or criminal case is, I think, depriving the client of the sort of searching examination that ought to be made of these cases.
So, Mr. Mack, I'd like to go back to your original hypothetical. Can you hear me well enough right now?
I can, just barely, but yes.
So before there was the first hearing in the state of Minnesota, there was the Jarvis case. I went back this morning and reviewed the Jarvis opinions by the Supreme Court and this court. And, they said ordinarily, we trust medical personnel and most situations, but the court's responsibility to a committed person does not cease. There's always the possibility of inappropriate medication. And if the person is incapable of consenting, if there's no guardian, I assume, then there should be judicial approval. Now, I don't think that the Supreme Court in that Jarvis versus Levine contemplated that there would be a full-fledged contested trial with, necessarily adversarial. I mean, you made reference to a criminal case or an ordinary civil case, but presumably we have, a medical professional whose interests are aligned with the patient. And so let me ask you the hypothetical. Do you really think that if the Supreme Court that decided Jarvis versus Levine had seen this record and the trial had lasted an hour, which you think is a short amount of time, I think conceivably that Supreme Court would say that's a long period of time for judicial approval. Do you really think that that Supreme Court would have found this to be a denial of due process?
It might have, especially if it were connected not simply with the Jarvis case, but with the commitment case. I mean, this is two things. It's a Jarvis case and it's a commitment case, and probably the commitment is more serious than Jarvis. What would they have done with Jarvis if Jarvis was the only issue before the court? That's hard for me to say, but I think that had Jarvis gone up allied with a case involving civil commitment, it might very well have found that it was inadequate. Any more questions? My time is about up.
So, and is there any case law in favor of your argument about the due process, the minimum due process required for a Jarvis hearing in connection with a committed person?
That I don't have, I'm sorry. It may exist, but that question wasn't before me when I wrote my brief.
It appears there are no further questions. Thank you for your argument, Mr. Mack. You will have a chance for a rebuttal following respondent's argument. Counsel for respondent, I believe it's Mr. Welch.
That's correct, Your Honor. My name is Aaron Welch. I'm an assistant Candiota County attorney appearing for respondent. May it please the court, counsel. I think that the court asked a lot of good questions of Mr. Mack, and some of them were, frankly, identical to the questions I was trying to ask myself as I was attempting to draft my responsive brief. I was trying to pin down, and admittedly, as I reread my brief, I may have come across a little more snarky than I intended. So if that's the case, I apologize to everyone. But I really had a hard time trying to pin down exactly what I needed to argue. As Mr. Mack again reiterated today, he isn't arguing ineffective assistance of counsel. So I didn't go through that analysis. He's really is simply challenging, kind as he said, the global procedure on a commitment, which frankly smacks more of wishing that the law around commitment were different rather than this, that any particular error in this particular case. And I understand that, that's fine, but I think that's better brought to the legislature than to the Court of Appeals, quite frankly. There's certainly no claim here of procedure, of a lack of procedural due process. I mean, certainly Mr. Trevino had a hearing, he had counsel, he had the ability and the forum to make his case. As far as substantive due process, again, I think everything that was there to be argued could have been argued. There's certainly nothing here of where he was quote unquote railroaded, or there's nothing here that I believe shocks the conscience or anything else to assert that he didn't have substantive due process. On Mr. Mack's point, excuse me, that, on the issue of Fry Mack or subjecting the two professionals here, I don't think that their diagnoses were really that different. Are they identical? No, I'm not going to say they're identical, but Dr. Seifer Lynch indicated that the diagnosis was unspecified schizophrenia spectrum or other psychotic disorders. And Dr. Lundberg said schizophrenia with rule out for traumatic brain injury. I given the fact that Mr. Trevino wasn't willing to meet with at least Dr. Seifer Lynch, I don't think those are that different given the facts that they had in front of them. So that's, I think Mr. Trevino had every opportunity to be heard, had quality counsel, had a good judge who asked or presided over a thoughtful hearing. I don't think there's anything here that that would indicate a lack of due process, frankly. Just to be very clear to what Mr. Mack was alluding to, Mr. Trevino has been provisionally discharged about 10 days ago. He's living at home at his sister's home here in Candiota County. He actually had a hearing in court yesterday that I was at where he pleaded guilty to a crime from 2016, which is kind of how this whole thing originated, quite honestly. It's the third time I personally have been to the Court of Appeals on a case involving Mr. Trevino over the last 4 years. He's had ample due process at every step of the way. I'm not sure if the court has any specific questions for me, but I don't have a lot else to present by way of affirmative argument, I'm afraid.
So, Mr. Welch, I have questions about whether this case is moot and whether there's, I think we have a duty to assure ourselves that we have a live controversy before we continue to consider the issues that were briefed. So, I mean, I'd like, either party may bring this to our attention by motion, but both of you have given us information and argument. So if I believe that the order that's under review does effectively three things, and I'm looking at page 5 of respondents' appendix, which is the, there's four paragraphs under the caption order in the court's order. The first one is simply incorporating law. I'll wait for you to grab it, just so that you can have it in front of you while I'm asking you some questions.
By the way, Your Honor, I can't see you. I have something saying Keith Evidence has entered the waiting room for this meeting and it blocks you.
Still true?
No, I still can't see you. That I have a pop-up that's blocking you.
So in the upper right-hand corner of your screen, Mr. Mack, choose gallery view. It's the matrix of 9 dots, 9 squares in a box. Do you see that?
I think this is it. Yes, now. Wonderful.
Okay.
Your Honor, I apologize. What page did you indicate?
Page 5 of the district court's order. It's also okay. Page 5 of respondent's appendix. I mean, I think these three paragraphs are the... These are the three actionable items for the district court's order, and I'm wondering if each of them still is binding or whether there's a subsequent order that has altered it or whether subsequent events have made the issue moot. So the first paragraph 2 says he is found to be mentally ill and in need of commitment. The court orders that respondent is committed to the custody of the commissioner for 12 months. Is that paragraph of the order still in effect?
I believe it is, Your Honor. As Mr. Mack indicated, I when I was looking up to double check his status, Mr. Trevino's status, it is a provisional discharge. So I don't know that it's, I think Mr. Mack actually put it pretty well, but I think it's probably practically moot, but I don't know if it's legally moot because something could happen to revive that. I do think that's theoretically possible.
And then in paragraph 4, it says the following neuroleptic medications, ... may be administered to respondents by the treating physician, ... without the consent of respondents. And then there's a list of them. Is that paragraph still in effect?
So the best information I can give the court on that is obviously well outside the record, but the court's asking me, so I'll give it the best information that I personally know. In the hearing we had yesterday, Mr. Trevino indicated that he is currently taking his own medications. He takes one medication. I don't recall the name of it off the top of my head or if it's one of these, but he did indicate on the record when we were going through the plea petition that he takes one medication, that it is for schizophrenia. But I don't believe that the Jarvis portion of forced medication is still in effect.
What if he doesn't take the medication? I gather there'll be the potential for a bringing back on the provisional discharge.
I think that's certainly possible, Your Honor.
So maybe another way of asking it is, is his treating physician still authorized by court order to administer neuroleptic medications without his consent?
And as I can't answer that question with 100% accuracy, but it would seem that that's not currently happening, that he is administering his own medications. And for what it's worth, again, well outside the record, but Mr. Trevino did indicate yesterday during questioning from the district court that he no longer believes that he has a chip in his head. We didn't get into any messianic things, but it would seem, thankfully, that Mr. Trevino is honestly doing very much better right now.
Would it be fair to say that what we have here is an initial commitment for 12 months, and before that 12 months elapsed, there was a provisional discharge.
I believe that's 100% accurate, Your Honor.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, it appears there are no further questions for Mr. Welch. Mr. Mack, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you. I'd like to go into Judge Johnson's questions first. Mr. Welch and I know a good deal more about this than the Court of Appeals does because we've seen, you know, subsequent orders. But I think that the case is not moot for two reasons. Obviously, and the commitment is provisional. And should he be found, you know, on the street corner showing signs of mental illness, that provisional discharge could be revoked. Similarly, with the jars, while he has the right to administer his own medications and is doing so, suppose he stops doing that, then the court would have the right to, in a fairly immediate process, impose the old Jarvis order on him. So I don't think it's moot. Now, one of the things that Mr. Welch said that I think is a little problematical is he said, well, maybe the legislature can solve this, but the legislature isn't the appropriate body usually to deal with due process arguments. And if it did try to impose various kinds of requirements on the court could very easily say, as it said, particularly in the case of TPRs, that the legislature has no business telling the courts how to do their business.
Well, didn't the legislature, I mean, after Jarvis v. Levine, I think the legislature immediately passed a statute to basically implement the ruling in Jarvis v. Levine to give district courts specific procedures to follow thereafter. Isn't that true?
That is true. The thing that I think this is one of the most underdeveloped areas of the law, which is how legislative determinations of how courts should proceed deal with Article III issues of how courts can determine their own procedures. If the legislature had, what the legislature did though, really didn't accomplish much because everything that the court said in the Jarvis versus Levine case was already being instituted by the courts. Last thing I would say is that this kind of issue couldn't really or was not developed in the district court because the district court basically didn't challenge the due process kinds of things that I'm challenging here. I think that what we're doing here is perfunctory. I think it is undignified from the point of view of the mentally ill person. In the case of Mr. Trevino, who I understand from Mr. Welch and from other information I have doing just fine now, if he had been in that position when this was imposed upon him, would have said, what are they doing? They're railroading me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mack. Thank you, Mr. Welch. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments. The case is submitted and the court will issue its opinion in the time required by law.
By the way, would the court want to have the subsequent orders before them to deal with the mootness issue?
I think, speaking for myself, I think it is a matter for either party may elect to bring a motion just either to supplement the record or for other relief. And that is a matter for both of you to consider, but at the time being.
But if neither party moves for some action because of mootness, we won't need all those additional orders, would we?
Yeah, I think Judge Klapacki stated it well. And if the court does wish to see more materials, the court will issue an order to that effect.
Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. This case is submitted.